voulais dire, tiens, tu peux inviter moi.
Can you tell me, and I'm sure you've told the rest here, what the edition is of the Upanishads that you're using?
I not used any.
What that you would recommend for me to?
For the translation, I think Swami Prabhavananda's is very good.
Is that in the paperback, the one that I've seen?
I think they have got here. Mm-hmm. It's called the Song of the Eternal, something like that.
Breath of the Eternal.
Breath of the Eternal, right. And that expression, Breath of the Eternal, is also found in that particular section where Yajnavalkya instructs Maitri. That's a good thing to start with. But the Upanishads are much, much larger and much wider.
Yes.
Much, much bigger in scope.
What is the name of that section?
Yajnavalkya and Maitri. It's called Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. That's highly inspiring. Provided you can dramatize the whole thing within yourself. Add, subtract, do what you like. Dramatize it within yourself. Only then it's possible to recreate the Upanishad. As I read it, I must be sitting face to face with my Guru and letting it happen in then it's fantastic. If you also want to debate with others and sort of win trophies and things like that, there's a lovely translation of the Upanishad by Dr. Radhakrishnan. It's very good. But
how do you spell his name? How do you spell his name?
Radha Krishna.
Oh.
Dr. Yes, Radha Krishna. Highly scholastic, tremendous. I think it's Oxford University Press. And I hope you'll also remember while you study either or both. You finished writing? When you read either or one or the other or both these, I hope you will remember that one page of it produced enlightenment in someone or the other. He didn't, that person, for instance, Maitreya was not involved at all in any other teaching of the Upanishad. She probably heard sort of, you know, while she was cooking or mending Yajnavalkya's clothes, she probably heard him talk to his students about Brahman, eternal, and so on. But otherwise, she was not directly involved in that, in the teaching. And the whole section of Yajnavalkya Maitreyi dialogue takes only about 2 pages in that book, 2 or 3 pages. And in that period of 2 or 3 pages, she attained enlightenment. And try to see if more of it makes more light or less light. And there was another young man, Svetaketu. He went to his father for instruction. And the father told him, Tattva Musi Dava, that 9 times. And he attained enlightenment. That will probably be the last one we'll take on Friday. He repeated 9 times and that fellow attained enlightenment. You can read it. You can read it 9 times if you like, or 9 times 9, and see what happens to you. And then one begins to wonder, why is it that he had it and I don't have it? In answer to that question, they come up with all sorts of these rules and regulations. He led a very pure life, he led a highly ethical life, and he did that, and he did that, he did this, he did that. Right, and then I turned around and see that he did all that. He never spoke a lie, he never smoked, and he never drank, and he never ate meat, and he never drank wine, he never had sex, and all the lot. And you look at him, he is just about the same as I am. You understand me? We are going from the goal, or from perfection, to try to see what has gone wrong where. And so I see that that man did not have these qualifications. And then I come around, I see a man who has got all the qualifications and yet who is stupid. I'm told then that, oh no, he is vain, he is proud. I come around and see another man who is extremely proud and humble also, in addition to all that. Then they say, no, his previous karma, his previous karma was not good. So the starting point was wrong. I must start here. I must start by saying, I don't know anything. I don't know what happens. I don't know why this thing happens to me, why that thing happens to him. Why it is that in spite of all my sannyas and renunciation and all the rest of it, I don't have the enlightenment that he... It is also all manner of atrocious things. How is it that he gets it and I do not? I'm puzzled even with regard to these qualifications. And while I'm not arguing, I'm not sort of, rationalizing. I'm not asking why at all, I mean, in that sense. I don't know. At that moment, there is true humility. That's what they saw. They also saw the same thing. True humility arises when there is a deep and from the bottom of your heart, you feel, I don't know why I'm like this and he is like that. Well, he's like that. I'm ready to fold my palms, I'm ready to bow down to him without questioning. And then there is deep humility. Along with that humility, there is a clear and direct understanding that I don't know what all this is about. These are all merely words. I don't know what they are talking about. Because they talk about self-knowledge and then immediately they turn down and say, if you have the self-knowledge, you will be free from fear. You will be free from anxiety. I only see that I am not free from anxiety. I am not free from fear. I don't know what that self-knowledge is, still. And then the inquiry starts. Then the whole thing, the whole adventure begins. And as it progresses, as this adventure progresses, as I begin climbing this mountain of self-knowledge, then all the qualities and qualifications that they prescribed as if they could be got from a drugstore prescription. All the things that they prescribed, I suddenly find them in myself, that's all. I do not acquire them. That's another faulty practice. If you acquire a new car with four wheels on, you tend to be proud. And how come that you won't be proud if you acquire all the qualifications of a yoga student with all the four qualifications? You can be proud again. I am a man of great wisdom. I am a man of tremendous renunciation. I am full of good qualities, and I have got burning desire for liberation. I have. If I acquire them, I become proud of them. If I do not acquire them, but during the course of this quest for the truth, they come into me, or they grow into me, there is no possibility of becoming proud. And perhaps you are not even aware that you have these qualifications. Because the acquisition of the qualifications themselves is not the goal. The goal is something else. While you are pursuing that, this thing is added unto you. You are looking for something else, these are added unto you as you go along. Then they are real.
That's what I've gotten from what you've said, and it's been an immense weight off my back. Knowing that I don't have to try for them anymore.
You cannot. I don't say you do not have to. You cannot.
Yes, there's no point in it.
Mine is the quest. And as the quest progresses, I see the obstacle, and the obstacle is very clear. If you say a spiritual aspirant should not marry, must be celibate, then I come and bring Ramana Maharshi and show you, no, he says no. Or Yajnavalkya was a married man. That sort of thing. I must see that it can be an obstacle. To me, Yajnavalkya was married, that is his business. Not mine. Then the mind does not compare and contrast, and how is it that he can do that and I cannot do that? It's none of my business at all. In this quest, when something happens, I see this as an obstacle. I remove that obstacle. And the removal of the obstacle is the virtue. It's as simple as that. And it becomes a virtue only when I see the opposite of it as an obstacle to be removed. Then there is no glory in the virtue. It's not an embellishment. It is a bit of a nuisance. I pushed it away and there's little virtue in it. I don't even see it as a virtue. I see it as a removal of obstacle. That's it. Why shouldn't you bluff others? It's quite simple. I can sleep better. If you bluff others, then you go, you don't know, something might happen. Take sleeping pills. I don't want to sleep. Take sleeping pills. That's all. It's quite simple. Why shouldn't you hate somebody else? It's a waste of time. I'm punishing myself for hating somebody else. That's it. One must see all these as obstacles to one's own quest. Then we are proceeding from the right foundation on to this same. Maybe we all meet on the same mountain peak, but I must start and get going from where I can start and get going.
I don't see any point in the debates. I never have seen any point in debates, even outside of the Upanishads, but how do you... what place do you see them as having?
Yeah. They have something peculiar to this, just one Upanishad, that again the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And I suppose they were intended to show the other aspect of it. I don't know if I... I think I mentioned. I mentioned two points in connection with this teacher-student or guru-disciple encounter. That one, the student very humbly approached the guru and asked for enlightenment, asked the relevant questions. And number two, that even an enlightened man did not instruct his own father or etc., etc., close relation. I think one day I told you the story of Janaka. What's his name? Shuka. Shuka, who had to go to Janaka instead of receiving enlightenment from his own father. But here, in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and especially the giant of an enlightened man, Yajnavalkya, he seems to not bother about these qualifications. He was the one who taught his wife. There's just one more example, and that is in the Bhagavatam, where a young sage, Kapila, instructs his own mother in self-realization. These are the only two or three examples I can think of. Otherwise, it's taboo. And I suppose they it was just factual that these debates took place, and they were inspiring to the listeners who recorded and passed them on, preserved them. And it may also have the same impact on the student now, on you, on me, now. We are reading both the dialogues between the seeker and the sage. Why do we read them? Because we want to derive some inspiration from them. And we may also, in a similar fashion, derive some inspiration from this confrontation between the two debating parties. The subject matter of these debates, as also the dialogues, is invariably the ultimate truth, reality. Except that in the language of Gargi or the others mentioned in the debates of Yajnavalkya, the language in their case is a bit stiff. It's not the language of a disciple coming to you for enlightenment. It's more, hey, in what are all these players resting? Janaka also asks the same question. Janaka does not challenge Yajnavalkya. Janaka is a disciple. And so when he goes to Yajnavalkya, he folds his palms, sits at his feet and says, please enlighten me. How am I able to see? What is the light in which we function? But whereas in the case of Gargi, she says, hi, tell me. She's like an examiner. Two types of people question others. One is the student who questions the teacher in order to gain knowledge. The other is the inspector who questions the student in order to examine and test. But that is not the rule. The second is not the rule. It occurs only in this Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and only in the contest between Yajnavalkya and his adversaries, competitive rivals. And in the case of these debates, I suppose it's clear that the party that is really benefited is the third party. Right? You two argue. I sit and listen. That's great. While you are driving along or doing something at night, especially if you are caught up in some kind of dark areas, so it's good to test. Take a walk and say, my God, how do I know? I didn't want to be lighthearted this morning, so I didn't give you the story. There is a very relevant and beautiful story in this Nasruddin stuff, one of the Nasruddin books. He is visiting us. Yeah, he is visiting some friends, and it becomes dusk. Nightfall, and it is getting darker and darker and darker. The friend says, "Mullah, light the lantern or candle. You'll find one." He says, "It's getting dark. Soon we will not be able to see anything. Already it is dark. So, light the candle, you will find one on to your right side." He said, "You fool, if it is dark, how do I know which my right side is?" You say it's dark, you cannot see anything. When you cannot see anything, how do you know which is your right side? It's a serious question. What is it in me that knows even in total darkness that this is my right hand? We have taken it for granted.
Memory.
No. The knot tied to that mala. How do you know what is memory? You suddenly remembered a word. You wanted to say it. What is memory? That's it. So why say it?
But we've become used to thinking that this is our right hand, and so we don't need...
No. Right. No. Phrase it differently, if you like. It is dark, pitch dark. You can do that. How do you know that these fingers are at the end of your arm and that you can squeeze those fingers? Normally you cannot.
Because I've done it before.
Okay, but I've done it before in light. But it's dark, I don't even see that they are there. How do I know that there are fingers at the attached to this arm? How do I know anything at all? How do I know you have a back even now? That's it. That's the question. The medical scientists have some theory that there is one little part of the brain stem or something, that it knows where, which part of the body is when. It looks funny because we have never thought about it. We have taken it for granted. You take it for granted till someone points out that it is difficult. Who was it? Avril? I don't know if you know. We are playing fun with throwing peanuts into the mouth. Some people cannot do it. I never realize that it's difficult. We have done it from childhood. Taking it, go on throwing like this. And when we did it, some here?
In a restaurant. Awesome.
Right. And suddenly somebody was struggling. Every time he threw it, once went into the nose, one went into the we have taken it for granted that it is easy. We have taken it for granted that it's easy to eat with your fingers. Till you come and watch a clumsy person saying, all the soup is dripping. Ha 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 ha. So we have taken it for granted that it is possible to know when a small ant is crawling on your back. Then you begin to question, my God, how do I know this? I don't see it at all. Then suddenly something else happens. Aha! If it is possible for me to see the ant crawling on my back without eyes, without light, in the light of the inner light, inner understanding or knowledge, it's possible for me to see the mind, see a thought arise, see a feeling arise, see an emotion arise. I don't ask anymore, how can I see all this? How can I see this ant crawling on the back? And still I know it's there. Here again, the quest is important. Though I mentioned this morning that we go from reality to reality, but we go from reality to reality. The quest is important. If I accept this as the reality and go to sleep, I've gone to sleep. I accept this as reality without assuming that there is something higher or lower or whatever it is, but question this. Even to the extent of, is this the reality that I unquestionable reality. So I take it as a reality because I see it, it's real to me, I am questioning it. The two put together leads you further and further on. Walking through a dark tunnel, what is the light that guides me? How do I know that I am alive, for instance? Good heavens, I could have died before. How do I know that I am alive? And at the same time you, yeah, this I may forget later on because it's not part of the stories, Upanishad. The Jnana Yogis or Vedantins have, it looks bad to say this, have divided spiritual experience or enlightenment experience into two parts. One they call Paroksha Jnana,